How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
It is Locked On NBA. I'm David Locke, host of Locked On NBA, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, and creator of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Super fun show coming up with a guy I really enjoy spending time with, Sam Amick of the USA Today. He used to be the Sacramento Bee. He's been with a bunch of people. He's a longtime writer in the NBA, has great insight. He's done a really super piece recently on Luke Walton. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the magic sauce of the NBA. We'll talk about the Clippers. We'll break that down. We'll look at a bunch of different players and theories and things. A lot of DeMarcus stuff at the end. New ownership of the NBA and how they deal with winning and losing. A really, really enjoyable conversation with Sam today. Today's show is brought to you by Indochino. Use the promo code LOCKED and you can get any premium Indochino soup for just $389 at Indochino.com. Promo code LOCKED, premium soup for $389 and free shipping. I've done it. You should too. I got myself a new brown suit. And SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the number one spot for you to go get your tickets to any sporting event or anything else. Use the promo code LOCKED for your first time, and they'll send you a $20 rebate. So thanks to Indochino and SeatGeek. Sam Amick is a guy I really admire because he's always trying to get better at what he does. He works incredibly hard. He digs deep into stories. He comes up with great angles. He was pretty good recently and being out there kind of on the front of the Phil Jackson and his take on that. But I really admire his work. He does the A to Z podcast with Jeff Zilgit. You can get that one and subscribe to it. It's very good. And I know Sam just, he works incredibly hard to get better. He's naturally a great writer. He's become a very good podcaster and audio guy. And he's someone I enjoy talking with. And I think you can tell that in our conversation. We're just two guys talking the NBA, having a blast. We kind of even go off kilter at some point, start sharing story ideas with each other. So this is Locked On NBA, all part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Not only is there Locked On NBA, but there is an individual podcast every single day for your favorite team. Who's your favorite team? Search Locked On, whomever that is, Locked On Heat, Locked On Clippers, Locked On Lakers. And there is a podcast for you every day, Monday through Friday, about 15 to 22 minutes, a little bite-sized piece to you for you to get an expertise insight on your team. It's a great way to be the most up-to-date possible on your team, so make sure you subscribe to your local team's podcast as well as this one, and thanks for the five-star review. Let's get this baby rolling. As I said, one of the guys I truly admire in the business, not only because he's just good, because he really works at it and tries to improve his craft in all aspects. Sam Amick, joining us from USA Today, from the A to Z podcast, all those things. Thank you very much. I can't believe that you and I have never done this. We have talked a lot of basketball in our lives. To have never done this is somewhat absurd.
We have, man. We go back a long ways. I mean, you were teaching me a few things about analytics back in the day, in Utah, and it's been fun to see you, David, become a podcast superstar, and I'm trying to follow in your wake and have our little fun on the A to Z pod, but good to be here, buddy.
For all you know, the A to Z pod was an inspiration. I'll tell you why later. so it's a good one. Make sure everybody grabs that. All right, so let's pretend that there's somebody who was in Antarctica on a trip, or coming back from their Mormon mission, use a Utah reference, or they are a huge football fan, hasn't paid any attention to the opening 26-7 days of the NBA season, and they said, all right, well, update me. What are the big two or three takeaways? What are your big two or three takeaways right away?
I've been doing a lot of Clipper stuff lately, so I'm going to start there naturally and say that, like you said, if the people weren't paying attention, you'd say, hey, you know, you might have heard that we were putting the Clippers on the outside looking in and maybe even telling a few jokes about how their time had come and gone and they just couldn't get out of their own way. And Blake Griffin had a bad year last year in every possible fashion. The Clippers are back. They are a very good team. We'll see if they can sustain it. They've got a good formula. They got more depth than they have ever had. Doc Rivers seems to have gotten the hang of the GM thing a little bit, made some nice moves this summer that helped them get back in the game. And it's not just the Warriors NBA like we thought was going to be the case. So that'd be a major takeaway. I'm traditionally kind of Western Conference heavy. So I'm going to stay in the West for the second one and say, you know, speaking of teams that know how to get it done, the Spurs, yet again, transition.
It all started in Tim Duncan,
no problem. And they got Pau Gasol in there trying to get comfortable. But the Spurs and Coach Pop and R.C. Buford and the rest of those guys not going anywhere, even though some of the greats have hung them up. And then, you know, I mean, I guess I'd say the champs are still the champs. The Cavs look good, and LeBron is not ready to give over that, you know, unofficial trophy of best player in the game. He didn't like all the Steph Curry talk these last couple of years. And so LeBron has not only brought a title back to Cleveland for the first time, but he's trying to do it again, and they look good.
So let's go back to the Clippers. I mean, our good friend Howard Beck, I think it was May 3rd last year, writes that big piece, like the end of Lob City. Is this the end of Lob City? It felt like it. There's a chance. What do you think changed in L.A.?
For now, it feels like this perfect storm of circumstances that is really helping their cause and putting them in a great place kind of mentally and emotionally as a group. So, and I'm actually going to write a column on Blake today. I sat down with him a couple days ago, and shameless plug, we're going to have that whole interview on the podcast too. And he was pretty good. Everything from his passion for stand-up comedy to a little bit of what happened last year. Nothing in great detail because I knew he was going to clam up if I asked him about the scene at the Toronto restaurant where he was taking swings at the assistant equipment manager. But to your question, David, you've got a couple layers here. You got free agency this coming summer. So these guys are all smart guys, and they know that Blake and Chris Paul both can be free agents and that J.J. Redick is unrestricted. So they know the clock is ticking. They know that Doc Rivers has made a choice at several different points to not break up the core. They know that people don't expect much out of them. The Warriors, for the most part, seem to have put them in the rearview mirror, and the respect is not what it used to be. So they kind of know, in Blake's words, and this is something he actually included on the when he apologized for what happened last season on a Players Tribune article that he wrote, he had said that there was a certain power in getting into F it mode. And that's, I think, where a lot of them are right now. They got nothing to lose, and they look really good. But I kind of alluded to it before, the depth, I mean, that's all narratives and storylines and life stuff. Basketball-wise, X's and O's-wise, adding guys like Raymond Felton and Brandon Bass doing some nice things and Austin Rivers helping and Jamal Crawford re-signing and getting most space, which has been really nice. That depth has changed things, not only just offensively with that second unit, but defensively they've been really good. And you're just seeing, it's a sound team. It's a team that they can grind it out, you know, the best defense in the league right now, and they're playing well. We just got to see if they can keep it up.
I'm stunned their defense in the second unit has been good, because when I saw them, they looked like five statues, but early in the year, but they've changed that. So I asked Doc a year ago, we played them early in the season or preseason, and I asked Doc at that point, is there a moment in time where a group of players has had too many collective negative experiences? This was before Blake punches anyone out. And right. But it was the Rockets loss and the other playoff series loss and the DeAndre Jordan leaving them divorce and then coming back. And he gave me an answer about how, well, we changed up our roster and so it won't be. And I just don't think it was true. I think that was what happened to them last year. I think they just had a bad mojo. This year I asked him, why would it be different? Say almost to the year, to the date, to the question. And his answer was, because last year these guys feel as though they didn't get to dictate their own terms. That
right.
Their season ended because of injuries, and they want to dictate their own terms. Now, that sounds good, and it's been hunky-dory, but I got to suspect that it's still very fragile.
It might be, but, you know, and maybe I'm drinking the Kool-Aid but it felt very real. And I had a lot of exposure to it. I went down to LA, full disclosure, mainly because I wanted to write about Luke Walton and the Lakers, but being in LA, I did some Clipper stuff. And so got a taste of what was going on then. And that was last week. So I guess 2 weeks ago at this point. So then they roll through, and as you know, I'm still based near Sacramento. They roll through Sacramento, and I get to talk to him. And I think what Doc says about them wanting to dictate their own terms, I mean, I did hear a lot about that. I mean, you got Blake and Chris, who both were in very good places last year in the playoffs when they got hurt. Chris was playing some of the best ball of his career. In fact, I had done a sit-down interview with Chris at that time and was ready to kind of try to capture how good he had been and where he was trying to take them. And then he got hurt, and that interview never saw the light of day. And then with Blake, you talk about a frustrating year. A lot of it self-inflicted, obviously, because of the fight. But you got the quad injury that even before that happened just wouldn't go away, and he thought he was going to get back, and it kept kind of, you know, holding him back. Then you got to get over the broken hand. And then in the playoffs, as he's not even 100% trying to find his way, he's back on the shelf with the same quad injury. So they do feel like this combination of self-inflicted wounds and bad basketball mojo and the gods being against them has put them in a place now, again, where it's kind of, I mean, it feels like potentially the end of the road. It feels like the effort thing, like what, why not just try to get the most out of this group in this moment in time and see what we can do. If we have injuries again, stuff we can't control, then that just is what it is. But they're good right now, and you know they got to keep their tenants all the way through the season, though. I mean, they had a game against Sacramento the other night where the defense disappeared, and so, you know, people are so skeptical of the Clippers and like, show me in April and May, and that's fair. But right now, I mean, I think they're the best team in the league.
If fellow podcaster J.J. Redick, I'd just like to say that.
Yes.
If he puts on his performance he put on last year, then they're great. I mean, he's the key of the whole thing because his efficiency is just through the roof. I have my own offensive analyticals way I judge players. He was top six in the league last year.
Wow.
I mean, if he puts on what he did last year, then they are just truly great. You mentioned Luke Walton. You did a great thing on your podcast with Luke Walton, and you wrote about him. We'll see how long this lasts. I think I do like what they're doing. I feel like they're mini Portland. They have 48 minutes of two guards that are both really good offensively when they have Russell and Nick Young coming at you, and they have Clarkson and Lou Williams coming at you for the other minutes. They're not as good as Damian and McCollum, but they have 48 minutes of it, which is important. So I'm not sure how long this truly lasts. But what was your takeaway from Luke?
It's funny, David. It's probably a little bit of an indictment of my reporting and storytelling on that piece, because honestly, one of the major takeaways, I didn't really talk about or write about that much, is the elephant in the room of the Kobe factor and the idea that the power of his personality not being there every day now like it was before, and the kind of tough to quantify ripple effect of that, you know, last couple of years we knew that some of the young players might be behaving and playing differently because of Kobe's presence, but it was tough to just hypothetically talk about how that would look compared to Kobe not being there. But now that we have the before and the after, it's just impossible to ignore the difference. And it's a touchy subject because his kind of legend in LA is certainly well-deserved, and it is what it is. But these guys are playing free. They don't feel like it's somebody else's locker room. They don't feel like it's somebody else's team. And Luke gets a lot of credit for that because he comes in, obviously, as a guy with a lot of history with Kobe, telling them, all right, that was then, this is now, and here's what I need out of you guys. But he's empowering the young players, and his style is drastically different from Byron Scott. I mean, you're talking about Byron, a guy who had been a head coach for a lot of years, and a lot of times the tone that he was setting and the message he was sending was all about, you know, here's where I've been, here's what I've done, here's what I need out of you, you know, but you're just simply not on my level, and here's how you get there. And that just didn't resonate with those young guys. And Luke is coming in with this interesting combination of humility, but firmness and clarity, I think, and communication, and getting these guys to play hard, getting them to feel like there's a real future here, and it's working. Now, that being said, you kind of alluded to this. They're going to have a little bit of a splash of cold water in the face here, I think. They've already lost 3 out of 4 as we sit here talking. They got the Thunder coming up, the two games against the Warriors, and I'm cheating and looking at the schedule. I mean, the Hawks, Pelicans, Bulls, Raptors, Grizzlies, and then your Jazz. So the schedule is really tough, but this is a much better start than we thought they would have.
You touch on something there I think is very interesting. So you've got to make an environment where the players like to go to work, right? I mean, no different than any of us. They have to like to go to work. And so if Kobe's in that locker room, you didn't like to go to work. Let's, you know, he's yelling at you and, you know, there was nothing joyous about him. So move that aside. How do you create an environment that's joyous, that's fun, and yet is still disciplined? Right? Those are, seem to be the magic words. You want the discipline of Pop, but you want the joyousness of Steve Kerr and now Luke Walton. Like, how do you mix and match those things?
It's hard. And Mitch Kupchak talked about it a little bit with Luke. And Mitch, obviously, having been part of the front office that drafted Luke as a player and knows him very, very well, 9 seasons with the Lakers, 2 titles. But he was even learning things in these early days with Luke as a coach that he said he didn't know. And one of those things was that he had a firmer hand than Mitch had anticipated. That, yes, he's good at the put your arm around the guy thing that has a certain impact, but he is also firm when he needs to be. I think the luxury that Luke has right now is that you can go heavy on the empowering of the player's style right now. It reminds me a little bit of, this is obviously not apples to apples in terms of the quality of the teams, but like Steve Kerr, when he first went to the Warriors, he went down that same road. And it was, I'm here to help you. It's all about you and putting you in the best position to succeed. Over time, Steve has evolved as a coach, and now it's more about how, you know, this is where you're falling short and you're not doing what we need you to do. And so Luke's going to have that evolution too. But you just, you know, I think you got to have a good sense of relationships, and you have to know where you are at with your most important players all the time. You got to have your ears open. You know, you can be talking, but you got to listen too. And I think that's the kind of thing that Luke is going to be good at, because just as a person, as a human being, he is generally known as a kind, smart, you know, person with good instincts. And that's going to get you really far when it comes to the coaching ranks.
He is Sam Amick. He writes for USA Today. He hosts the A to Z podcast with Jeff Zilgit. You can catch that on wherever you listen to your podcasts as well, here on Locked On NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. And today's show is brought to you by Indochino. Indochino.com, if you haven't checked it out, custom menswear. The difference between having one of those kind of off-the-rack suits that doesn't really fit and having a made-to-measure suit, it's incredible. I loved it. I went through Indochino. You're picking from all sorts of fabrics and looks and patterns. You can even customize the inside of the jacket lining, however you might want. And then you go through it and you're like, wait a sec, what was custom about this? And then all of a sudden it happens. Submit your measurements. What it is, shoulder to shoulder, your arm lengths, your waist, everything about it. And you then kick back, relax, and 4 weeks later you get a premium suit. And if you use the promo code LOCKED, it costs $389. The difference between how that suit fits you compared to that off the rack, oh, it's incredible. You look so much better and you feel good too. Check it out. The site's easy to use. The selection is incredible. Or you can go to one of the 9 North American showrooms, Indochino.com, promo code LOCKED. Made to measure premium suits at 50% off with free shipping. I adore this. It's the best. It's the best way for a guy like me who's not making the money that, frankly, the players are making in their custom suits or the coaches are getting in their deals. I can look good and it didn't break the bank. Promo code LOCKED, $389 for a premium suit at Indochino.com. So the league is 30 teams trying to find this one elusive championship that, frankly, is determined by having a star, not anything else. So then you get into, like, well, how do we make ourselves best? Do you feel like anyone out there has a magic sauce? Do you think there is a magic sauce out there that teams are grasping onto or that some people have figured out that others haven't?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's the easy answer, but, and I thought about this coming in to our chat, David. I mean, it's got to be the Spurs. It's still the Spurs. And I think there's more meat on that bone than you know, you might think, I mean, some folks might roll their eyes and go, all right, that's not an outside the box answer, but it's the Spurs because they're doing it again. I don't know the numbers, but they lost a number of guys in their front office. You know, Sean Marks obviously going to Brooklyn, but there were some lesser known guys as well. Brian Gauss is a young guy who does really good work, and he went to the Timberwolves, and they have restocked their front office shelves with some young, talented people to surround with R.C. Buford and Greg Popovich. And they have a large staff, and a staff that one of the things I love about them is they always kind of make it sound like the Houston Rockets to get to compare another team. Daryl Morey, obviously, at the forefront of the analytics movement. But they've always told you, you know, that it's been very clear what their belief system was, and they will hold that flag and say, you know, yes, this is how we see the game, and this is what's important to us. The Spurs have always almost tried to pretend they weren't in that same bucket, even though they were. You know, they're good at all of it. They're good at the human relationship side and the old school understanding of coaching and what Pop does so well, but they're also good at finding competitive edges in every single possible fashion. I mean, and doing that by hiring capable, you know, large staffs who do the kind of work that puts them in a position to win. So it's still San Antonio, and it's fun to watch them on the fly because of that transition that we talked about at the top of our conversation here, and the idea that Tim Duncan's retiring, Manu Ginobili is going to be next. Tony Parker's still got a few years, but they're going to have to figure out what the future is of the point guard spot, and they're bringing along Kawhi Leonard in a pretty amazing way, and Marcus Aldridge is getting more comfortable in his second season. So they're not just kind of sitting here toasting as one of the elite organizations in the league. They've got their own battles to fight, but they've got a great knack of checking, I think, more boxes than anybody else.
And what's really interesting to this is on the analytical front, they are not playing the offense analytically, but they are playing the defense analytically. So what I mean by that is the league has gone to this game where you want to shoot threes or shots in the restricted area. And they shoot one of the lowest percentage of smart shots offensively in the game, except for the flip side. In fact, they're 29th. They only shoot 51% of their shots as smart shots. They're 29th in the league. Like, you almost have to think if they're 29th in the league that it's conscious. And yet,
sure,
defensively, last year they were number two in the league in defending smart shots. This year they're not as much so there. But it's an interesting aspect of, you know, everyone else has kind of gone to this groupthink analytically. They're not doing it. And yet we think of them as the ones with the magic sauce.
We do. I mean, I'm just conjecture here, but you got to imagine that some of that is they're always very aware of the human component. And I think you know that if you have a core group that is still getting to know each other, and that's what they have. I mean, LaMarcus spent a lot of time in Portland, and he's talked openly about how much different it has been getting comfortable in San Antonio. Pau Gasol, same type of thing. You're featured heavily in Chicago. Now you're playing a different role with the Spurs. And so I think if you're Pop and RC, if pushing your personnel too far towards what the analytics tell you, whether it be focusing on smart shots offensively, things of that nature, if that makes your players uncomfortable to a point where you then get diminishing returns and they're not able to do what they do best, then it's just simply not worth toying with. It's simply not worth doing. And I wonder if that's part of the thought process where, you know, those competitive edges, I think, for the most part, can be found most effectively with the groups that have the most chemistry, the most, you know, the continuity. And that's when I think you can exploit some of those things. We've seen the opposite extreme at different times with the Rockets, where they have overhauled the roster and you got all these mismatched pieces, and then you are very deliberately trying to tell them to play a certain way, and it just hasn't had the impact. So, I mean, that's part of what I love about covering this game, is finding the different meaning and translation of what's actually happening and why teams are playing a certain way. I mean, that's pretty interesting stuff.
So back to the question I asked you, if I answered it myself, of the guy who's come off his trip to Antarctica, Mormon mission, football fan, his team finally lost their seventh game, whatever it might be, I would say that the, and this is typical to, you know, I can't answer a question straight. I have to do something stupid, and, you know. My takeaway of the opening month of the season is that the evolution of this analytics of the importance of the three and defenses taking away the three has suddenly made it so that star one-on-one players are more valuable than they've ever been, and more importantly, they're able to prosper like they've never been able to. I actually think Terry Stotts, what he did in Portland last year, may have sent a little message to the league. But, I mean, you run down it. Darren, you know, DeRozan, Harden, Westbrook. I mean, we knew about a lot. Lillard. The great players in this league are simply unstoppable right now.
It's unbelievable. And it's fun to watch. I mean, I just saw a number this morning from ESPN's Mark Stein. I give credit where credit's due. That
because they do.
Russell Westbrook.
Oh, did you hear that cheap shot I threw out there? Okay, sorry.
They've always been good to me. I got no complaints.
All right.
But
wait a sec. I want to say this. In fairness, there has been a quantum change in the last 12 months at ESPN, and they are attributing it to people rather than just getting their own sources on stories they're already reported. So I will
tell you. Well, in fairness, I think with 22 is there's times when I almost think there's an overcorrection where, you know, you'll see, just widespread credit given to stories that they were also on top of. But that's for the next media podcast that we'll do.
You can do that. You can do it with Richard Deitch.
Russell, there you go. So Russell Westbrook has 5 triple-doubles, which is the combined total of everybody else in the NBA. But he is averaging in those 5 triple-double games 37.2 points per game as compared to 22 and some change for the rest of the league, which I just – my mind was blown when I saw that number. And we know that the Thunder's formula is probably not sustainable and the load that he's carrying is tremendous. But whether it's Westbrook or Harden with the 30-point, 15-assist numbers that I wish I could put into historical context, but just know that names like Tiny Archibald are being pulled out of the woodwork.
Actually, can I jump in here?
Yeah.
We played the Rockets, so I just put him in historical perspective. And the answer is nobody ever. Like, nobody ever. Like, you go back and look at all the guys. First of all, 20, Russell and James. So if you just take their numbers down, right? Because I always hate, like, oh, let's just look at guys that are exactly at their numbers. So take their numbers down to 25 points, 5 rebounds, 10 assists. Okay, they're way over that. The only guy to ever do that's Oscar, and the last time he did it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Then you get to...
In a different league, just to interject real quick, the part that I've always feel like gets lost in that is people just don't quite understand how fast the game was back then. And it's not to take anything away from Oscar, but those types of numbers were easier to come by then than they are now.
Particularly the rebounding numbers.
Right.
The second one on it is you take the 25... You can go do this search. This is the one I think so incredible for both Russ and James. 25 points a game... and then go find what the highest assist total ever are with 25 points a game, and you're at like 11.4 in the history of the game. And
right. And
I think Harden was 12.8 when we played him the other day. They're blowing this stuff out of the water. I think it has to do with the change I talked about in the game. And I think Harden's – I don't know if I think Westbrook's sustainable. Watching Harden the other night, he wasn't exceptional against us in any way, shape, or form, and he dropped all those numbers. Like, I don't remember exactly what he finished with. I think he finished with 30 and 14 or something crazy, and he wasn't exceptional. He really wasn't at all. He didn't go to line.
He had 31 and 10 against you guys. And 10 of 24 shooting.
What did he do at the free throw line?
Free throw 7 of 9.
Okay, well, that's nothing for him. Like, there was nothing. He was really good, but he wasn't crazy.
No turnovers.
Yeah, we don't force turnovers. It's a little bit of a problem. James Harden and Emmanuel Mudiay just went back-to-back games against us without a turnover. That might be a problem for us.
Jeez.
But particularly the Emmanuel Mudiay part. Nonetheless, and George Hill's hurt, so that could be part of it too. But I mean, really, that's like nobody's ever done what these guys are doing. I think it's because of the outbreak of three-point shooting that nobody is helping defensively the way they used to, so that when these guys now get going, there's just even, at least on Houston, on Oklahoma City, I don't know how Russell's doing it, because the other night I'm watching, he's surrounded by 3 non-shooters, Oladipo, who's a questionable shooter, who's shooting it well, but he's not a great shooter, and how he's finding ways to the basket, I have no idea.
It is, like you said, though, your initial thesis, it's fun to watch, and the MVP race, put it, here's my thing anecdotally. You know, we file weekly MVP rankings, and we have about 10, I think it's 10 or 11 people who vote throughout the USA Today Sports Network. So that includes myself and Jeff Zilgit, our NBA editor, Kevin Spain, some other folks that we have who help on the NBA team, AJ Newhart and Mike Singer, these other guys. And then we have other NBA beat writers from other markets where their papers are owned by Gannett. So bottom line, we all vote, right? I end up sending my stuff in and just really being frustrated so far this season because the level of disrespect that you're giving to, you know, guys who are just killing it right now, because we only file a top five.
Oh.
And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, I mean, I don't honestly, LeBron, put it this way. I think overall LeBron was number one on our rankings last week. I didn't even have LeBron in my top five. So, I mean, that right there shows you how great the superstar play is right now. And you end up trying to quantify also, I mean, you know that the MVP is going to come from a top two or three team. It almost always does. But even the teams like OKC and Houston, who are more middle of the pack, I mean, it's hard not to look at these guys and have just MVP screaming at you. I mean, they're playing incredible.
Kemba Walker's another one, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And Charlotte's been really good.
Yeah, I think both Houston and Charlotte finished top four in their conference.
Yeah, I mean, easier for Charlotte to pull off than Houston. But the Houston one's interesting. Where, and I'm going to cheat again and look at defense. What's the...
I think they were about 18th.
Maybe. Yeah, you're right. Middle of the pack, 105.9 per 100 allowed.
But their offense is going to be top five. If you're top five, you win a lot of basketball games.
Right, and they're four right now, offensively. I love the D'Antoni move, partly because I like Mike a lot. I think he's a good guy. He's about the right things. And I also just love, and you're going to give me story ideas here, David. I mean, I need to probably connect with Houston and just talk about the revival of Mike D'Antoni's name and the fact that, you go from the Phoenix Suns days where, if anybody forgets, because I know it's been a minute at this point, but he was, I mean, if you had a conversation about NBA people who were chronicled in the kind of legendary way that he was, but they didn't actually win a championship, like he might be on top of that list. For people who didn't win a title, and 7 seconds or less, the phenomenal book with Jack McCallum, sorry. So you're at the top of the mountaintop almost. You just don't get the title, but you change the NBA. And then you have your name kind of dragged through the mud in New York and L.A. with some tough situations. To see Mike go out there and be innovative and be bold enough to put the ball in James's hand as a point guard, and to see what they're doing is fun to watch.
I just talked to him the other day, and I can send you the soundbite. I have kind of decided that every now and then the cliche question actually gets me the best soundbite, and so I have to do it, even though it kind of breaks my heart inside. So I just asked him, when you did this in Phoenix, you ran this system, and it was unique and nobody understood it, and now everyone's doing it, right? So how is it different to coach now? And it was interesting to have him. He talked about how he could throw out lineups when he was at Phoenix and no one could counter them, right? If he dropped Joe Johnson at the four or something, nobody had. And now everybody's roster is built in a manner so that if he does that, they actually have the answer. That you're almost negligent now if you don't have a small ball lineup in your roster. And so I thought that was a really interesting point on his part, that's how
I mean, he's longing for the glory days when he had the secret sauce that you talk about. I mean, that is really interesting, because now he's going to have to get even more innovative to take it to the next level. He's essentially paying the price for having, in his way, the impact on the game that he had. Because, I mean, as great as the Warriors have been the last couple of years, I don't think D'Antoni gets enough credit for starting a lot of this stuff. And Steve Kerr, was in Phoenix, obviously, at that same time. And the irony of that backstory is that Steve, at different points, didn't support Mike's way of playing ball. I mean, he was part of the group that went out and got Shaq and was trying to make sure that you had a big and a more traditional approach. Mike is the one who opened a lot of eyes when it comes to this stuff, and I think you're still seeing the effects of that.
There's even a – you'll have to look this up. Let me just say this is two guys talking right now. I'm not entirely sure this is completely accurate, but this is my memory, and it's probably 14 years ago now. My memory is that Mike gets offered the GM job, turns it down, and then they hire Steve Kerr.
And that part could be true. I don't remember that part. The other interesting thing, though, is Steve really wants Mike to hire a defensive mastermind and wants him to hire Tom Thibodeau, and Mike resists. And that was one of the things kind of leading to the end. Where, you know, that them not being on the same page. And so, you know, all that stuff is interesting. And it's not as cut and dried, again, as to say that Phoenix started it, the Warriors with Steve Kerr continued it. It's just, there's a little more nuance there.
Well, I've always done this podcast as though it's just two guys talking about the league who really get along, and we welcome the listener in to just join us for the three guys sitting at the bar. And they just happen to be really quiet, but with the amount I talk, they never get a chance. So I will now, if you're going to do a story on D'Antoni, the other thing I would add into that is if you go back to Europe, I believe his point guard in Europe is maybe Yesakevich, and who was the best European point guard at the time, who is now the head coach, who's now coaching there and is one of the most successful coaches. So his legacy is not just how he changed the U.S. game, but how he brought the European game, and yet his former point guard is still, I think, the most successful head coach there in Europe right now. There you go. How's that for, like, just...
I didn't know that. It's good knowledge.
There you go.
It's very good knowledge. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. All right, let's go. I was going to... I had another question for you that I pre-prepared you for because I thought it was out of the box a little bit. What's the next big headline? What's the next big kind of, I don't know, earth-shattering, landscape-changing NBA thing that happens? You can give me two or three possibilities.
I think, well, to me, you got different kinds of headlines. You got concrete headlines, whether it's this guy is going here, you know, the trade stuff, and then you've got the possibilities. I think it's going to be pretty tough to get all the way to February 23rd without some real, like, significant DeMarcus Cousins trade discussions, because the Kings, it's that age-old formula of losing basketball team. They're 5-9. They had a nice win last night over Toronto, but they're 5-9, and DeMarcus Cousins has 1 year left on his contract after this year. You've got a large sample size. He comes into the league in 2010. I looked this up the other day. Their winning percentage since then is, I think, around 34.4, and only Minnesota and Philadelphia have been worse in the entire league since 2010. So all of that leads to me just saying that when the phone rings with a lot of teams wanting DeMarcus, the Kings would not be doing their jobs if they didn't have those conversations. And those conversations are, A, who knows where they will lead and what might happen, and then B, likely going to find their way into the media with us talking about some of the possibilities. So, as you know, people this time of year want to talk about superstars and who might be on the move. That one, I think, is on the horizon. And then as a quick aside, you know, Rudy Gay's made it real clear that he doesn't want to be in Sacramento anymore. So where does Rudy go? Does the Oklahoma City scenario rear its head again? Does he go to the Thunder? I don't know who else we're talking about here. You know, like, even to keep it with the Kentucky theme, guys like John Wall and Anthony Davis, who are probably miserable in their situations right now, I don't see them being moved. They both got more years. I mean, especially Anthony. Anthony's not going anywhere. He's got a lot of years left on his deal. So I'm still trying to get a sense of what trade season is going to look like. I don't know how you see that stuff, but you know, I think that's probably what it'd say.
If Beal and Wall really don't get along and they just can't win, then they probably have to do something because they've committed to Scott.
Yeah, Brooks. I just know they have, and I just know. I mean, they love John, man. Like, they just,
well, then Brad, you know, then Bradley, can they get someone who wants to take Bradley's max contract that they just signed him to?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the upside you have for any NBA team thinking those kinds of thoughts is that with these salary cap spikes that are happening, you know, every deal you have now is better than the one you're going to sign next year. And so in that regard, maybe you can find a new home for Bradley. But it is that, I mean, that we talk about the age-old formula of what typically leads to trades, that the Wizards certainly have some of those components. You have the pressure that comes with hiring a new coach, so you are not going to find him responsible. He's not going to be the one who pays the price here. You have the animosity, acrimony thing, where it's not just John Wall and Bradley Beal. It's Marcin Gortat deciding a couple games into the season that he's going to throw everybody under the bus and tell reporters that they have, like, the worst second unit in basketball, which I'm sure that really helped team chemistry quite a bit. So, you know, I don't know how they fix it. And again, when their phone rings, they're going to have these conversations. I think that one, if John moves somewhere, I would imagine and guess that at some point he got tired of the situation and told them, you know, it's time for me to go. And then maybe, you know, because of that, they start changing how they have conversations with other teams.
Let me be clear on something. I actually was listening to Locked On Wizards, which is part of the Locked On Podcast Network, and they were talking about that the Bradley Beal, John Wall story's got much more kind of depth to it on a local level, and it's been picked up on this national thing, and we all kind of run with it. And I'm pretty cautious on things like that. I want to tip my hat to them that they're saying that, hey, maybe they're not best friends, but this whole idea is maybe a little overblown, and there is a tendency right now in this internet world that the minute the story gets out there, it just gets further, you know, moved along without ever really checking. So I just want to throw that out there, is that there might be a little.
I agree, but just real quickly, and I'm not close, I don't want to pretend to be close to it either. In fact, my colleague, Jeff Zilgit's the one that you guys could chat about this at a later time. He's based in D.C., and he goes to a lot more Wizards games than I do. But the one thing that I will say when it comes to substance and indisputable information on that story is that when you have players like John openly talking about the way that it impacts the way they play the game, this is not soap opera stuff. We're not talking about how, you know, we don't hang out enough anymore, or, you know, some kind of non-basketball thing like that. John has made comments about Bradley seeing an open look and not moving the ball again out of selfish motive and thing. You know, that's the stuff that obviously it, in some form or fashion, it has bled onto the basketball court leading into this season, and that's the stuff they got to work out now.
Wrapping up with Sam Amick, the USA Today NBA national writer, host of A to Z podcast here on Locked On NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Make sure you go grab your favorite team's daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. All right, before we get back to more Sam, grab your phone, go to the Play Store or the App Store and download the SeatGeek app, because this is going to make your life better. Because SeatGeek puts all the tickets available from all the sites in one place for you, so you save time, never miss a deal. Then, when you go find the game you want to go to, or the concert you want to go to, or the theater event you want to go to, or the whatever it is, you look on there and it shows you the arena, the stadium, the theater, and it shows you which tickets are best because they give every ticket a ticket score. And so instead of trying to figure out and looking up on the map and saying, where's my best view? They'll just tell you, you know what? This ticket right here is a 93% ticket score. That's the best value. Click on that and you have got yourself your ticket to the game, and it's guaranteed and it's secure, and it's the way to get it done. So do what I just said. If you haven't done already, download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, and enter the promo code LOCKED, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you make your first ticket purchase. It's the taking something that was a pain and using technology to make it easy and to make it guaranteed and to make it secure. So go to SeatGeek, enter the promo code LOCKED, and you get $20 after your first ticket purchase, and you will thank me, because SeatGeek will make your life better. I want to wrap with you on this. I loved your Vivek story that you did. I thought it got a lot of play. I thought it probably should have gotten about 10 times more play for a lot of reasons, but here's why. I've thought the number one story for the next decade in this league is going to be the new ownership that all rose up in a win-win.com era, that while Vivek was making his million, so was Lacup, and so was Ballmer, and so was every, and they all won at the same time, and then they all have this, it happens to anyone who hits that big suddenly believes, they buy their own myth, they believe in themselves. Howard Schultz in Seattle was the greatest example of it, and he quit on it. I think the story of the league is going to be for the next decade is how these guys deal with failing and deal with the fact that only one team can win. Your thoughts on that in connection with how much time you spent with Vivek, who's kind of been, you know, I mocked is probably not the fair word, but I think he's been, you know, he's been vilified a bit.
He has. He's been a punchline. And that was the irony of our conversation
was probably, I mean, arguably any interview I've ever done, David, if you heard the audio version of the interview and then kind of tried to reconcile that with the reaction in the public, the gap couldn't be any farther. What I mean by that is, at the time, of course I was going to ask him about some stuff in the past, but at the time it seemed like his motive for talking about that stuff was trying to set the record straight on a number of different things that had led to him being a punchline in the NBA. And I'll be honest with you, at the time and talking to him, I didn't fully process kind of how badly it was going to go. The mood between he and I was still very good. We walked out of that room, you know, telling jokes and saying, thanks for your time. It was very positive. And then it was like, once I listened to the recording, it all kind of hit home like, oh my goodness. I mean, he threw a lot of folks under the bus. There's going to be a lot of reaction to this, but the narrative that you're talking about, the greater theme, I think you're dead on. You have so much money in the NBA these days, and it's just, it's not like the old days. These are businessmen who get the taste for wanting to be NBA owners, and then they often apply business sensibilities to an NBA organization. And while parts of that attack and that approach might work, for the most part, it doesn't. Then that's followed by frustration because these are powerful men who are not used to failing. They don't know how to handle not only the failure, but the public failure. And Vivek, early on, and I think still, has struggled with that idea that his stuff doesn't stay in-house. That really bothers them. Usually, if you're the guy who owns a company in Silicon Valley, what happens in your board meeting is not on a blog hours later. And the NBA, it is sometimes. So that all of that is interesting. I think another subplot here, and you could do a whole pod on ownership politics and dynamics, is that because of the cost of these teams these days, you have, and Vivek is certainly not alone in this regard, you have guys like him who are the chairman and the lead person in the ownership group, but who technically, he owns, I think it's 17.2% of the team. And that's actually up from a couple of years ago. Somebody gave up their shares, he bought them. And people a lot of times assume that the majority owner means 50%+. There are a lot of teams, by the way, like Jerry Reinsdorf in Chicago, one of them, Joe Lacob with the Warriors, one of them, where the voice of the top guy seems to far outweigh the actual stake of ownership. And so then you get all these minority owners who want a voice, and because they've got a lot of skin in the game too. It's a really tough environment to succeed, to keep everybody happy, you know, and to have one voice and one approach and one strategy because of all of these different factors.
It's going to be really interesting to see, because I thought what jumped out to me, and maybe this isn't true, but he just wouldn't admit he was wrong on anything.
Yeah. And, no, I mean, that's fair.
And that's how Howard Schultz was with the Sonics. He wouldn't admit he was wrong on anything. Like, I mean,
yeah.
He thought that when he bought the team, he thought that he could, like, mold these guys' lives and put them through ropes courses and become their father figure and all this stuff. And they don't, like, that's not what they were looking for. Like, they didn't want a third place to have their cup of coffee. Like, they wanted to play basketball. And, you know, the owners want their, but, you know, half the teams are going to lose. Like, it's not a win-win game. And I think it's going to be the challenge. This league's in great shape, but I think that's going to be Adam Silver's biggest challenge as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, to your point of Vivek, you're right. Because I remember the first question I asked him was very simple. And it was, how are you different as an owner 3 years in than you were in the beginning? And we know, I basically told him, we don't need to talk about all the bumps in the road, but we know there have been a lot of bumps. And what have you learned, and how are you different as an owner? And his response to that, instead of chronicling the ways that he's different, his response was, well, let's not forget, in the beginning, you know, nobody was here. It was a ghost town. Nobody even wanted to be here. And that's where he started insulting the Jeff Petries of the world, who were trying to do their best at that time. And so there wasn't a lot of accountability. And I think that's what didn't sit well with the fans. And what you're talking about league-wide is dead on, too. Excuse me. It's just the fact that I think, for one, the superstar stuff you talk about, there's only so many in the league, and so everybody's chasing trying to get their star, but you need at least two to be either elite or a winning ball club. You know, one doesn't get it done. We talk about the Kings and Cousins, and you know, it's the parity is something we got to monitor. That being said, I'm kind of excited for the sake of the league that the Warriors story this year has been much more interesting than I thought it would be, which means this is not the irrelevant regular season that we thought it was going to be. The Warriors are absolutely beatable. If you're putting money on it right now, I think you're probably putting your money on somebody else to win the title. So that bodes well, you know, for the overall landscape. But I agree. I think, you know, these teams trying to find a way to survive and not fall off the map is going to be tough.
You just pointed my other right? We're never going to end, and we need to. My other one is there's just not very many bad teams. I think that was my other takeaway. If I talked to the guy who was in Antarctica, is that there just aren't that many bad teams. We played Denver last night. They're good. They put up 48 minutes of solid lineups. They're going to win between 35 and 42 games. They're good. There are going to be a lot of teams that win between 35 and 42. One last question for you, because I just thought it was too big to leave out. We were back in it, and I didn't put it where it should have been. But back to Cousins and back to Kobe. So take this full circle. Do you think DeMarcus – I heard you on a podcast. I can't remember with whom. Sorry, my bad. Talking about your neighbor who can't handle DeMarcus Cousins' body language. I'm actually your neighbor. Like, when I call games with him, it just drives me crazy. But I can't imagine having to play with him. And so do you think he's got the Kobe – we talked about you want to have your locker room where it's fun to go to work. Do you think the other 14 guys in the locker room – want to go to work with Cousins? I've heard nasty stories about his bullying and some of the stuff he does to people. Do you think that the other 14 guys want to go to that locker room and go to work with DeMarcus Cousins every day?
I don't. I mean, in the past, some are probably better at dealing with it than others. And obviously, I'm not the beat guy anymore these days. I can't pretend to know every day what's going on. But the stories are still there. And I even, I got a glimpse of it even this season. I went to a quick Kings practice and he was, he made a quick little aside remark to a reporter that I thought was just stupid and just unnecessary. And so that vibe, I kind of, my takeaway at that moment was like, all right, same old stuff, I guess. And the problem is whether it's Jim or Nick Stauskas or Ben McLemore, you don't know until it's like the Kobe thing. You don't know until that presence is gone how they players like that might react differently in the absence of that presence. And then it's such a tough thing to figure out also because he's such a tremendous player because, by every metric, you talk about him not being on the floor, you think the Kings are bad now. I mean, it just gets ugly without him. He's great. I mean, he's legitimately a great talent. So I think the Kings are very, very aware of that dynamic. There's a reason during the offseason that Vlade Divac was in DeMarcus's ear about being a better teammate, being more inclusive, not being as tough, knowing when to be tough, but when to like Shaq has talked about this, be tough, but you got to turn around. I think he said recently on TNT that he had like a 60-second rule or something like that. Like after 60 seconds, you got to stop yelling at him and then say, hey, good job on this, good job on that. And the dichotomy between DeMarcus and Vlade fascinates me because Vlade, in the history of the entire game, you could argue that he was the best teammate ever. Like, you honestly could make that argument. There's a lot of great teammates. Vlade's on the short list, and he knows the power of that kind of influence. And then it seems like his franchise centerpiece just hasn't figured that part out. So I don't know what part that's going to play in the decisions that they make. I think first and foremost, it's what's the record going to be and what's the market for him elsewhere. But I think that other stuff's going to come into play too.
Sam, I can't thank you enough for your time. Keep up the great work on your podcast, on the A to Z podcast, and keep up the great work at USA Today. It's a pleasure to be your friend. Great to watch you work, and your continued quest to be better improves all of us. So I appreciate you very much.
Likewise, David. Great stuff, man. I appreciate it. Hopefully see you soon. Thanks buddy. Mike.
Huge thanks to Sam. I knew that was going to be fun. I hope you really enjoyed the show. Make sure you subscribe to your local Locked On podcast. Who's your favorite NBA team or your favorite NFL team? We have a Locked On podcast for both. So make sure you grab that. Matt Williamson does a nice job with the Locked On podcast for the NFL. So Locked On NFL. So make sure you grab that. Really looking forward to having you aboard a bunch of our podcasts. And thanks to Indochino.com. Use the promo code LOCKED and get your premium soup for $3.89. And to SeatGeek, promo code LOCKED. You get $20 rebate back. Have a great day. Thanks for tuning in to Locked On NBA and the Locked On Podcast Network.